will continue our study today in Exodus 31 with the section beginning in verse 12 concerning the Sabbath, in Hebrew Shabbat. Let's reread this rather short section to just kind of refresh our memories. Open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 31. It's on page 96. Page 96. We're just going to read from verses 12 to the end. Adonai said to Moshe, "Tell the people of Israel, you are to observe my Shabbats, my Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you and throughout all your generations, so that you will know that I am Adonai who set you apart for me. Therefore, you are to keep my Shabbat because it is set apart for you. Everyone who treats it as ordinary must be put to death. For whoever does any work on it is to be cut off from his people. On 6 days, work will get done. But the seventh day is Shabbat for complete rest, set apart for Adonai. Whoever does any work on the day of Shabbat must be put to death. The people of Israel are to keep the Shabbat, to observe Shabbat throughout all their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the people of Israel forever. For in 6 days Adonai made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he stopped working and rested." When he had finished speaking with Moshe on Mount Sinai, Adonai gave him the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God. The Sabbath is God's law about observing sacred time. Just as the tabernacle is God's law about observing sacred space. Now, this might sound a little philosophical rather than spiritual, but it truly is not. Let me explain. So hang in there with me, as this might seem a little bit complex, but it really isn't. A scientist would rightly say that we live in a universe that consists only of space and time. Space is three dimensions. Time adds one more dimension, giving us a total of four. The first three dimensions describe space. They're very easy to grasp because we simply look at this room and we see its length and width and its height. That's space. Three dimensions. What's not as easy to grasp is the concept of time. We can't see it. We can't touch time, but we can observe its effects. It is especially observable to me every morning I look into the mirror. Because I look at that wrinkled face with a little ring of gray hair around the top of my head, and I ask, who is that? Image sure doesn't look like what my mind expects or remembers. I don't feel like that reflection looks, although some days I do. Aging is the visible effect of time, but it's not time itself. So what is time? Well, just as an inch or a meter is the way we measure space, those first three dimensions we talked about, length, width, and height, time is actually a measurement of decay, as expressed in the second law of thermodynamics. All physical things decay, but they decay at differing rates. Time measures that rate of decay. A rock decays a lot slower than a human. But not all rocks decay at the same rate, nor do all humans decay at exactly the same rate. In fact, our most accurate time-measuring devices, atomic clocks, actually use the nearly perfect steady rate of decay of certain atomic particles to make them work. Now, this is not intended as a science lesson. It's a lesson to help us understand at least part of God's apparent rationale behind Sabbath. Now, since our God created a universe of four dimensions consisting of space and time, so he has ordained a means of enshrining the holiness of all four dimensions of his creation. The tabernacle is representative of the three dimensions of space. The Sabbath is representative of the dimension of time. God sanctifies the tabernacle by setting it apart from all other human space and dwelling in it. He sanctifies the Sabbath by setting it apart from all other blocks of time and declares that that specific block of time, Shabbat, is a holy block of time. No other piece of space at the time of Moses, and then for several hundred more years anyway, was set apart as holy to embody the holiness of space. No other block of time has ever been set apart as holy for the purpose of embodying the holiness of created time. Now, certainly other blocks of time, other days, other appointed times, have been ordained and set aside to honor other things God once honored, biblical feasts, for example, but none of these had the specific purpose of honoring God's creation of time itself. So the Sabbath is God's designated day to give tangible glory to his creation of the fourth dimension, time. Now, together, then, the tabernacle and the Sabbath enshrine the holiness of God's creative will. Now, keeping this in mind, let's see if we can, just what we can glean from these last few verses of chapter 31 about the Sabbath. The ending words of verse 13 is another of those interesting but usually overlooked small phrases that carries a large meaning. And the significance of it is explained in verse 14. At the end of verse 13, it says, "This is so you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy." Your Bible version may say sanctifies you, some may say consecrated you, or some such thing in the place of holy. It's all the same thing. The word holy or sanctify is translated from the Hebrew root word kadosh, which indeed means holy or to be holy, to be set apart. Now, but I want you to pay attention to what God seems to be saying here. He says that the purpose for Israel keeping the Sabbath is what? To make them, to make you holy. Now, this is no small thing, and it carries rather large implications. In verse 14, there is another interesting phrase that works in conjunction with the one we just looked at in 13. And it is most meaningful if we accept what it means in its most literal sense, which is usually the best way to take the Bible. What I want to look at is the word that is translated as holy in this verse. I'm talking about verse 14 now, not verse 13. In Hebrew, the word used here is kodesh. Although it's taken from the root kadash, it has a slightly different meaning. Kodesh does not mean holy. This is poor scholarship. In Hebrew, kadash means holy. So if kodesh, which is what the word used here in verse 14 is, if it doesn't mean holy, what does it mean? Well, in English, the closest we would get is it means holiness. Holiness. Most literally, this verse reads, and this is really interesting, "Keep the Sabbath because it is holiness for you." Keep the Sabbath because it is holiness for you. What's the difference? Am I splitting hairs? Not really. The way it's normally translated in verse 14 means to our minds, I want you to keep the Sabbath because I made it holy, and therefore you're to consider it holy and you're to observe it because it's a holy day. Right? That's what we do. But that's not the meaning. Here's what it does mean. I want you to keep the Sabbath because not only did I declare it holy, but the Sabbath will clothe you in a state of holiness when you obey me and you observe it. That's a big deal. I hope you see the difference. The first way is, I want you to do this because I made Sabbath holy. I want you to respect the holiness of the Sabbath. The second way is, observing the Sabbath, you take on the holiness of the Sabbath. It's the holiness of the Sabbath that, when imputed upon you, transmitted to you, gives you holiness. So verse 13 says, I'm going to make you holy. Verse 14 says, here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it by transmitting the holiness that's inherent in my Sabbath to you, if you'll obey me and observe my Sabbath. Now, this concept really shouldn't sound all that strange to us, because we are told that in order for us to enter the kingdom of heaven, we must be righteous according to God's standard. Yet it's utterly impossible for a man to attain that state of saving righteousness on our own. So by faith in something else, in Yeshua, we are clothed in God's righteousness. Yeshua's righteousness is imputed upon us. Yeshua's righteousness is transmitted to us. God is laying out the principle of that here in Exodus, that by means of his grace, he will impute upon Israel, he will assign to Israel, simply by his declaration, a state of holiness that cannot be achieved any other way. This also goes a long way towards helping us to understand what Christ really meant when he said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You see, he was saying that it was not necessary for the creation of man in order to bring holiness to the Sabbath, but it was necessary for the creation of the Sabbath in order that holiness could be brought to man. The seriousness of the Sabbath ordinance is underlined when in verse 14 it continues by saying that whoever profanes the Sabbath is to be cut off. They're to be separated from God. Cut off can mean that a person is destined to die short of a normal lifespan, or it can mean, like in this instance, that a person can be executed for failure to observe the Sabbath. And later on in the Torah, we're going to get an example or two of the death sentence being applied to someone who did not properly observe Sabbath. How long is this Sabbath ordinance supposed to last? Anybody know? Forever. It says so in verse 16. We don't have to guess. It says so. God says something else. He says the Sabbath is a sign between him and Israel. In Hebrew, the word for sign is ot, ot. And the sense of the word is as an affirmation or a proof or a mark of distinction. The Sabbath is a mark of distinction that sets the relationship between God and Israel apart from everybody else. And further on in verse 16, he makes this connection between the creation of the universe, as we spoke of at the beginning of our lesson, and the observance of Shabbat. Now, let me see if I can illustrate something for you. I said that Shabbat is a very specific block of time. It is the seventh day, and it's set apart from all other blocks of time in order to embody the holiness of time as the fourth dimension of God's creation. I was born on November 26th. So my birthday is on November 26th every year. What if I decided I preferred to remember my birthday on March 15th? How about if when March 15th came around, I just declared it in my home to be November 26th? My birthday. Now, while there certainly is no law against it, with equal certainty, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It kind of ruins the whole purpose of having a birthday. March the 15th is not November the 26th, no matter how you cut it. Each day is very specific and different days. They're not the same blocks of time. God's word, not me, the Holy Scriptures, defines Sabbath as the seventh day of each week. This set apart, sanctified block of time that the Lord has established as representative of the fourth dimension of his creation is the seventh day of every seven-day week. It's not any block of time of our choosing. We can no more choose our own definition of Sabbath than we can choose our own definition of Messiah. God is now through for the time being with giving Moses and the people of Israel his ordinances and his principles. And so Jehovah inscribes it on two stones, supernaturally by his own hand, the 10 principles from which all law, ordinance, appointed times, festivals, observances, rituals, even the sacrificial system is going to be based. So we have now completed 4 of the 6 divisions of Exodus, and we're ready to begin the 5th division, which Everett Fox calls infidelity and reconciliation. So open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 32. We're going to read it all. Exodus chapter 32. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 96. Follow along with me. When the people saw that Moses was taking a long time to come down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and they said to him, "Get busy and make us gods to go ahead of us, because this Moses, this man that brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Have your wives, sons, and daughters strip off their gold earrings and bring them to me." The people stripped off their gold earrings and they brought them to Aaron, and he received what they gave him, melted it down, made it into the shape of a calf. And they said, "Israel, here is your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." And on seeing this, Aaron built an altar in front of it and proclaimed, "Tomorrow is to be a feast for Adonai." Early the next morning, they got up and offered burnt offerings, presented peace offerings, and afterwards, the people sat down to eat and drink, and then they got up to indulge in revelry. Adonai said to Moshe, "Go down, hurry. Your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have become corrupt. So quickly they have turned aside from the way I ordered them to follow. They have cast a metal statue of a calf, worshipped it, sacrificed to it, and said, 'Israel, here is your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" Adonai continued speaking to Moses, "I have been watching these people, and you can see how stiff-necked they are. Now leave me alone so that my anger can blaze against them and I can put an end to them. I'll make a great nation out of you instead." Moses pleaded with Adonai, his God, and he said, "Adonai, why must your anger blaze against your own people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt with great power and a strong hand? Why let the Egyptians say it was with evil intentions that he led them out to slaughter them in the hills and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger. Relent. Don't bring such disaster on your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your very self. You promised them, 'I will make your descendants as many as the stars in the sky. I'll give all this land I have spoken about to your descendants. They'll possess it forever.'" Adonai changed his mind about the disaster he planned for his people. Moses turned and went back down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets inscribed on both sides, on the front and on the back. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And when Yehoshua, that's Joshua, heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "It sounds like war in the camp." And he answered, "That is neither the clamor of victory nor the wailings of defeat. What I hear is the sound of people singing." But the moment Moses got near the camp, when he saw the calf and the dancing, his own anger blazed up, and he threw down the tablets he'd been holding, and he shattered them at the base of the mountain. And seizing the calf they had made, he melted it in the fire. He ground it to powder, which he scattered on the water. Then he made the people of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you to make you lead them into such a terrible sin?" Aaron replied, "My Lord shouldn't be so angry. You know what these people are like, that they're determined to do evil. So they said to me, 'Make us gods to go ahead of us, because this Moses, this man that God brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him.' And I answered them, 'Anyone with gold, strip it off.' So they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf." Love that. And when Moses saw that the people had gotten out of control, because Aaron had allowed them to get out of control to the derision of their enemies, Moses stood at the entrance of the camp and shouted, "Whoever is for Adonai, come to me." All the descendants of Levi get rallied around him. He told them, "Here's what Adonai, the God of Israel, says. Each of you put his sword on his side. Go up and down this camp from gate to gate. Every man is to kill his own kinsman, his own friend, his own neighbor." The sons of Levi did what Moses said, and that day 3,000 people died. Moses says, "You have consecrated yourselves today to Adonai because every one of you has been against his own son, against his own kinsman, in order to bring a blessing on yourselves today." The next day, Moses said to the people, "You have committed a terrible sin. Now I will go up to Adonai, and maybe I will be able to atone for your sin." Moses went back to Adonai and said, "Please, these people have committed a terrible sin. They have made themselves a god out of gold. Now, if you will just forgive their sins, but if you won't, then I beg you, blot me out of your book, which you have written." Adonai answered Moses, "Those who have sinned against me are the ones I'll blot out of my book. Now go and lead the people to the place I told you about. My angel will go ahead of you. Nevertheless, the time for punishment will come. Then I will punish them for their sin." Adonai struck the people with a plague because they had made the calf, the one Aaron made. Chapter 32 is, of course, about the infamous golden calf incident. And the key to understanding these scriptures about the golden calf is that Israel was breaking the Mosaic covenant at the same moment Israel was up on the mountaintop receiving it. Now remember, this is a conditional covenant. Israel has its obligations to keep because the covenant has stipulations about what happens if they don't. God sees what Israel did by building the calf as adultery, therefore infidelity. Why adultery? Because they were supposed to be in a faith union with him, and they brought in another god. They tried to create another union. It's chapters like these that mark the Bible, I think, as the most remarkable piece of literature. Now, obviously, it's far more than literature. God has set apart a people from all other people in the world to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation unto him. And rather than try to paint Israel now as somehow better than other human beings, less susceptible, you would think, to doing wrong and evil, as above the temptations of sin and immorality, a bunch of people that just whistle a happy tune and go about God's business, praising him all the live long day, we're shown the reality of the human condition. Our fickleness, Our selfish and rebellious nature are vividly on display here in this chapter as a stark contrast to God's character, but also to his expectation of us. For the last several weeks of our study of Exodus, it is as though we've been eavesdropping on God's conversation with Moses. From on high at the summit of Mount Sinai, all that is good and true and perfect, that heavenly spiritual ideal of Israel, has been spoken and explained to Moses. Now, unfortunately, back at the ranch, the reality of everyday physical life, as it conflicts with God's standards, greets us head on. And we shouldn't sidestep the irony here. During the very time Moses is receiving incredible revelations from Jehovah, standing on the summit, the Holy of Holies, if you would, during the time God is lowering himself to send a love letter to humanity that beckons the Hebrews to reconciliation with him, the people of Israel are scheming to do the very things God has prohibited. Translation: yes, we know there's a God. We know he's loving and powerful. We know he has standards of good and evil, right and wrong. But we're anxious and we're stressed and we're impatient, so we'll take matters into our own hands. Thank you very much. Oh, how very human. We'll do it our way. The first few verses of chapter 32 set about explaining the people's rationale for breaking that second commandment. The one that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me, you are not to make a carved image. And basically that rationale is that they're anxious and afraid. They want answers. They want them now. Of course, I think last week it hit many of us squarely between the eyes that adultery was also at the heart of the Israelites' great offense against God. Adultery, if indeed the offense was indeed the offense, because what the Mosaic Covenant had created was a union between Israel and Yahweh. And by mixing the union with Yahweh, with the worship of the calf, by bringing another god into the picture, the union became corrupted and defiled. The union became broken. And whom did the Israelites recruit to lead them and this worst of all possible offenses against God, but the man who's about to become their high priest? Moses' second in command, the one who bore the staff of Moses, who spoke the miracles of God before Pharaoh, Moses' own brother, Aaron. Well, I mean, you could roll around the floor in laughter about this if it weren't all so tragic and typically human. We're told that Aaron agreed to build for Israel a God image, and he instructed the people to give him the gold from their earrings. Now, I'm not sure what significance there is that it was only earrings from which the gold was gathered, but one thing's for sure. There would have been an enormous number of earrings necessary to make this golden calf. So a lot of people agreed with what they were about to do, and they contributed to the process. Once the calf was made, just what did the Hebrews think they had done? I mean, what was it that they thought they had made? Who did it represent? The answer is contained in the last few words of verse 4 and into verse 5. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Aaron announced that tomorrow they'd build an altar. They would sacrifice an animal to the golden calf. They'd hold a festival to Yahweh. Your Bibles most likely say a festival to the Lord. Some may say to Adonai. That's incorrect. This has led many a commentator to suggest that the Israelites had an entirely different Lord on their minds. Maybe one of their old Egyptian gods. But the original Hebrew does not say Lord. It specifically says Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Yahweh, God's personal name. The people thought they were making a suitable image of the God of Israel, Yahweh, when they built that calf. By the way, maybe we all better examine the images and icons we use, because there's a ton of them around, and I'm not at all comfortable that our rationale for using them makes it right in God's eyes. Now, there's so many lessons just under the surface that we could spend an awful lot of time with them, and I'm only going to outline a couple of them for you. First of all, the golden calf itself was a common animal image used by almost every Middle Eastern culture. In Egypt, it was called the Apis bull, very high deity. It represented strength and authority, and the Hebrews would have been more than familiar with it. We can't know for sure that it was the Egyptian Apis that they used as a model for the golden calf. I mean, it could have been some other Middle Eastern bull god, but it doesn't matter. The point is that despite the incredible miracles they had all personally witnessed, after hearing Jehovah's own voice telling them the Ten Commandments, at the first sign of trouble, what was their instinct? Their instinct was to not believe God, to not trust God, to not be obedient to God, but rather to behave as they always had. The funny thing is that had worshiping other gods back in Egypt ever liberated them from Egypt? Had it ever brought them any good at all? Apparently not, because they were oppressed slaves for at least 2 centuries before God finally rescued them. But it didn't matter. They just went back to what was familiar, and they turned their backs on what was right. You know, people haven't changed very much, have we? When push comes to shove, we tend to fall back onto what's traditional and comfortable. We love the things we're familiar with, the things that seem to validate the lifestyle we've chosen. We'll compromise, we'll rationalize God's principles in a heartbeat if it satisfies our emotions or our desires. I've heard it said the true definition of insanity is believing that if you keep on doing the same things, you'll eventually get a different result. There's not one of us hearing this lesson, not one of us, that doesn't have to fight daily the urge to hang on to or to return to our old ways, even though we know the truth. Now, second of all, why did the people feel they needed a God image at all? I mean, what's the big attraction here? Now, interestingly, it's the human need for visible, tangible evidence of God's presence that drove them to this horrible deed. And it's that way, it's that same human need, that same human need for us to see with our own eyes that God was in the process of providing by means of the tabernacle. God knew. He knows. We need visible reassurance. We need visible evidence of his divine workings in our lives. Israel needed it too. God didn't need an earthly tabernacle. He certainly didn't need human hands to build one. The tabernacle, like almost all else, was for Israel's sake. It wasn't for God's sake. The tabernacle was a physical demonstration of some heavenly principles, as well as the enshrinement, for humans to see, of God's principle of sacred space. Now, there's a parallel, there's a connection between the golden calf and the tabernacle, as they were both intended to satisfy man's need to have visible proof of God's presence. It might do us well to think of the golden calf as kind of the anti-tabernacle. The golden calf is man's perverse idea of deity. It was made from Israel's best and most sincere religious imaginings and efforts. Conversely, the tabernacle was a heavenly model. It was God-ordained, but it would also come in God's timing, not in their timing. Man-ordained versus God-ordained. This is the battle that humanity has been fighting practically since the moment creation was finished. It's going to go on until the end of the millennial reign of Christ in the future. Probably within some of our lifetimes, we will see this battle played out in most dramatic fashion in the finale of the history of the world as we watch mankind install the Antichrist as the head of world government to rule over us. And why will mankind voluntarily, insistently install him? For the same reasons that Israel molded a golden calf. Impatience, fear, anxiety, the need for visible proof that God is present. Already the world is crying out for somebody to build that new golden calf. Do something to stop the violence, to stop the terror that has gripped the whole world. But there seems to be no solution. And soon, very soon, I believe that the apostate portion of the church is going to join that world effort, if not lead the way, to identify and install the end times golden calf, the Antichrist. And just as in Moses' day, this is going to occur as God is in the process of readying the world for a visible display of God's true presence in the form of the return of Messiah Yeshua. But it'll be in his timing. Sadly, we already know from the Bible, primarily Revelation, that most of the world and all but a remnant of the church will not wait for God's solution. We're going to take matters into our own hands, and there's going to be devastating results. That's what Israel did when they built that golden calf. Now, beginning in verse 7, God informs Moses of what he says to him. He says, look what your people are doing. My people? I mean, I think that's pretty funny that at this moment, God says, oh, no, they're yours. I mean, in a way, for a moment there, it seems God disowned them because all up till now, he'd been calling them my people. And guess what? Legally, that's what he did. He disowned Israel. The covenant was broken. Moses would demonstrate that fact when he arrived back to the valley floor. Further, it would be necessary to reestablish that covenant, which we also find Moses does as he fashions two more blank stone tablets to take with him back up to the summit of Mount Sinai. And as the Lord is instructing Moses, he tells him, oh, hurry back down that mountain, put a stop to this calf worship. And by the way, Moses, while you're gone, I'm going to sit here and think of all the ways I can destroy these stiff-necked people of yours. In fact, I think I'll just kind of start all over again with you as the new father of a special people for me. Well, Moses, in a very noble gesture, pleads for mercy for those Israelites, and God relents. Now, a couple things to think about. Was God kind of going back and forth here, one foot and the other, indecisive? I think I'll destroy Israel. Nah, no, I will. Yeah, I will. Back and forth. Of course not. Jehovah, as always, is in teaching mode. He's in Torah mode. He's showing Moses just how serious disobedience to the Almighty can be. He's showing Moses that indeed those people are his responsibility. God is demonstrating that it didn't have to be Israel that's his chosen people. It could be anybody. Moses is in the position of mediator. It is on his shoulders the sins of these people fall. The sins of what is now described as your people, Moses, because the covenant that makes Israel God's people has just become invalidated. In something akin to an episode of Seinfeld, I think, here are the people of Israel down at the foot of the mountain partying like mad, worshiping, sacrificing to this golden calf, just so proud of their little selves for solving their own problems. While at that very moment, God's telling Moses that by the time he gets back down there, these people are probably going to become little piles of human toast crumbs. And these foolish rebels, these silly Hebrews, have absolutely no idea that their fate is being decided up on that mountain summit as they go on in blissful ignorance down below. I also think that Moses really had yet to grasp his own importance in Jehovah's eyes as well as in the eyes of the people. You know, Moses had always been reluctant about taking this job in the first place. He was a humble man, and he was an introvert. And he had a hard time understanding why people would look upon him as a leader. But as we saw when God spoke the Ten Commandments by means of a thunderous, a frightening sound directly to the people of Israel, their response was generally, "Oh, wow, that was really cool. Now, please don't ever do it again." Moses, you go talk to God for us, okay? Have him talk to you. They were certain if they ever again were in God's presence, if they ever heard his voice again, they'd die. They saw Moses as their one and only channel between them and God, which, of course, is the very definition of indeed what he was. He was their mediator. The people of Israel depended on Moses as that mediator, and after a considerable time, when he hadn't come back down from that mountain, they did what people do when leadership vanishes. They panicked. And when they didn't see what they expected to see, when they expected to see it, they lost faith. The result was the golden calf. You know, I'm not sure I've ever made a good decision when I'm in panic mode, which is one reason why God constantly reminds us to fear not. Because fear always leads to poor judgment, irrational behavior. And as Moses was making his way back down that mountain, he runs into Joshua, that same Joshua that would eventually take over from Moses. Apparently Joshua went partway up the mountain with Moses and then stayed and waited for him because Joshua didn't seem to know what was going on back down at the encampment. But he could hear all this ruckus and he knew something not good was happening. And Joshua says, "Moses, I think there's a war going on down there." Moses says, "No, Joshua, they're just having a giant block party." So Moses finally gets to see what is happening. It infuriates him as he's never been before. He throws those tablets of the commandments on the ground. They explode into hundreds of pieces. He took the golden calf, he melted it down, he ground it to dust, he sprinkled it all over the drinking water, and he made the people of Israel drink it. Now, this act of breaking the tablets was significant. In the Middle East, whenever a covenant was made, written down, and then violated, the clay tablets it was written upon were ceremonially thrown to the ground and shattered. This signified the covenant was broken. So this wasn't entirely a moment of rage in which Moses just lost it for a second, and in doing so impulsively threw those tablets of the law down on the ground. It was a custom. And the people knew immediately what it meant when he did that. The hours-old covenant with God was broken. It was gone already. So Moses asks Aaron in verse 21, what happened that would make him agree to do such a thing as to build an idol? Aaron's answer, they asked me to. Peer pressure, social expectations, political correctness, a desire to be all things to all people, and place of godly leadership. Do I please God or do I please my friends? Aaron chose unwisely. Well, then Moses threw down the gauntlet. He called all those who stood with him and in so doing with God to come to him. Moses is doing what God demonstrated to us since the moment he separated darkness from light. He divides and separates in order to create unity. I know that this principle that God divides flies in the face of the typical modern-day Christian doctrine that God unites. But the unity at any cost doctrine simply doesn't square with Holy Scripture. Primarily because it's too simplistic. God divides and separates in order to achieve unity. I mean, my goodness, here in Exodus, he is well into the process of dividing Israel, separating Israel from the rest of the world as his people. And here in Exodus 32, we have Moses dividing and separating the people of Israel in order to achieve God's kind of unity. Division, separation, and election are God's ways to achieve his ideal unity. Now, sadly, the world and too much of the church have fallen into the trap that defines unity as a compromise to achieve consensus. God's unity has nothing to do with consensus or unanimity or conformance. Most certainly, it has nothing to do with compromise. Unity is a oneness with his spirit. It is us coming to conformity with him. It was the Levites, those who were destined to be the priests, the attendants to Jehovah, who rallied around Moses. Now please remember, the priesthood has not yet been established. These Levites who came to Moses were not declared priests yet. But we don't have to work that hard to figure out why, even from a purely human standpoint, it would be only the Levites who rallied around Moses. They were kin. Moses was a Levite. And by means of his current station, he was also the head of the Levite tribe. I mean, see, this is the essence of tribalism. Blood is thicker than water, or pretty much anything else for that matter. Each of the Levites took a sword, and they went about killing 3,000 of the calf worshippers. The wording makes it appear that they must have killed only non-Levites, but also fellow Levites as well, who had succumbed to that idol worship. And then in verse 29, Moses makes a startling statement to those who did the killing. Very interesting. By sparing not even your own sons, you have consecrated yourself to God. That is, given the choice between obeying Jehovah and executing your own child for idolatry at his command, you chose obedience to God above your own desires. That sets you apart. At this moment, these Levites were divided away from the rest of Israel, consecrated, soon to become God's priests. This would be confirmed a little later in a formal ceremony. Now, by the way, you know, the Levites are an interesting contradiction of character. Back in Genesis, when Jacob was announcing his deathbed blessing upon his children, he told Simeon and Levi that violence was always going to follow them. But he also told him something else that was now coming true. In Genesis 49, 5 through 7, we hear this. Shimon and Levi are brothers. They are related by weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let my honor not be connected with their people. For in their anger they killed men. At their whim they maimed cattle. Cursed be their anger. for it has been fierce. I will divide them in Jacob. I will scatter them in Israel. It was Levi and Shimon, Simeon, who led the raid on that helpless city of Shechem in revenge for the king's son raping Jacob's daughter, Dinah. Levi and Simeon slaughtered all the males of Shechem, killed their cattle, made slaves of the women and children who were spared. And as a result of this atrocity, Jacob said that Simeon and Levi would find their destinies as constantly dealing with blood and violence. But Jacob pronounced even more that concerned those two sons. Here the meaning of "I will divide them" in Jacob comes to light. Right here in Exodus 32, the Levites are divided away from the rest of Israel. That is, they are divided in Jacob. Remember, Israel and Jacob are just synonymous names. And then their violent natures are put to good use as they do what? They kill many of the calf worshipers, even including their own children, we're told. The second part of Jacob's prophetic blessing, whereby Levi will be scattered in Israel, will occur at the end of the 40 years in the wilderness when the land of Canaan gets divided up among all the tribes of Israel. But the Levites don't get any land of their own. Instead, they're going to be scattered, just as the prophecy said, throughout the territories of other tribes. They're going to be given 48 cities to live in, but under the charity of the various local tribal authorities. I think it's also interesting that the Levites many of who are about to become priests will be the ones to deal with blood and killing on an everyday basis. But then it'll be sacrificial blood. You see, the killing that God calls just is not murder. But killing outside of what God calls just is murder. God creates all life. How it ends is his to choose. What the Levites did at Shechem was unjust. It was murder. And they were under God's curse for doing it. But when they stood by Moses' side, they obeyed God, and they killed those 3,000 people, it was counted to them as a blessing, just as it says at the end of verse 29. So the overall fate of the Levites would not change from what Jacob had pronounced. But the nature of how it would be manifested did change. They would indeed deal in blood and in killing. But instead of it being unjust killing against God, it would now be as God's servants carrying out not merely justified killing, but killing that brought justification and atonement before God on behalf of Israel. God declares what is holy and just. All else is not. And it's not our position to alter his choices. Well, after the mass execution of the idol worshipers, Moses made it clear. Israel had sinned against Jehovah. They had broken the covenant. And as mediator, now he needed to approach God to see if there's going to be a way to atone for this corruption, and more importantly, to reestablish the Mosaic covenant. Moses climbs back up the summit of the mountain. He begs God to blot him out of the book of life forever, if that's what's necessary for the people to be forgiven for their great sin. In response, the Lord lays down the principle that each man is responsible for his own sins. So he declines Moses' offer of offering his own life as an atonement for Israel's sins. But sin must be punished. There's no alternative. Those 3,000 that were put to the sword by the Levites were just the tip of the iceberg. The number of those who willingly participated in calf worship was much greater than that. So God sent a plague as a punishment, and many more Hebrews died of illness. We're going to follow Moses back up that mountain next week in chapter 33.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.